The Christie Affair by Nina de Gramont, read by Lucy Scott. For Liza Jane Hansen. Part 1. Here lies Sister Mary. A long time ago, in another country, I nearly killed a woman. It's a particular feeling, the urge to murder. First comes rage, greater than any you've ever imagined. It takes over your body so completely, it's like a divine force, grabbing hold of your will, your limbs, your psyche. It conveys a strength you never knew you possessed. Your hands, harmless until now, rise up to squeeze another person's life away. There's a joy to it. In retrospect, it's frightening. But in the moment, it feels sweet, the way justice feels sweet. Agatha Christie had a fascination with murder, but she was a tender-hearted person. She never wanted to kill anyone, not for a moment, not even me. "Call me Agatha," she always said, reaching out a slender hand. But I never would, not in those early days, no matter how many weekends I spent at one of her homes, no matter how many private moments we shared. The familiarity didn't feel proper, though propriety was already waning in the years after the Great War. Agatha was upper crust and elegant, but perfectly willing to dispense with manners and social mores, whereas I had worked too hard to learn those manners and mores to ever abandon them easily. I liked her. Back then I refused to think highly of her writing, but I always admitted to admiring her as a person. I still admire her. Recently, when I confided this to one of my sisters, she asked me if I had regrets about what I'd done and how much pain it had caused. "Of course I do," I told her without hesitation. "Anyone who says, 'I have no regrets,' is either a psychopath or a liar. I am neither of those things, simply adept at keeping secrets. In this way, the first Mrs. Christie and the second are very much alike. We both know we can't tell your own story without exposing someone else's." Her whole life, Agatha refused to answer any questions about the 11 days she went missing, and it wasn't only because she needed to protect herself. I would have refused to answer too, if anyone had thought to ask. The Disappearance. One day before, Thursday, the 2nd of December, 1926. I told Archie it was the wrong time to leave his wife, but I didn't mean it. As far as I was concerned, this game had gone on far too long. It was time for me to play the winning hand. But he liked things to be his own idea, so I protested. "She's too fragile," I said. Agatha was still reeling from her mother's death.
"Clarissa died months ago," Archie said, "and no matter when I tell her, it will be beastly."
Fragile was the last word anyone would use to describe Archie. He sat at the great mahogany desk in his London office, all pomp and power.
"There's no making everybody happy," he said. "Somebody has got to be unhappy, and I'm tired of it being me."
I faced him, perched on the leather chair usually reserved for financiers and businessmen. "Darling," I said. My voice would never achieve the genteel tones of Agatha's, but by then I had at least managed to wash away the East End. "She needs more time to recover."
"She's a grown woman.
A person never stops needing her mother."
"You're too indulgent, Nan. Too kind."
I smiled as if this were true. The things Archie hated most in the world were illness, weakness, sadness. He had no patience for recuperation. As his mistress, I always maintained a cheerful demeanour, light and airy, the perfect contrast to his not-quite-fooled and grief-stricken wife. His face softened. A smile twitched the corner of his mouth. As the French like to say, happy people have no history. Archie never inquired after my past. He only wanted me now, beaming and willing. He ran a hand over his hair, smoothing what was already perfectly neat. I noticed a bit of grey at the temples. It made him look distinguished. There may have been a mercenary element to my relationship with Archie, but that didn't mean I couldn't enjoy him. He was tall, handsome, and in love with me. He stood up and crossed the room to kneel before my